breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio. SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Very good Monday. Race fans and yearling buyers, it's Monday of sale week, and tonight and tomorrow on the sales grounds. Really one of the great scenes in all of racing. Sirius 162 XM. 207 Sports Zone, 999 if you're listening that way, and at our website, stevebick.com. Certainly a Whitney, if we can compartmentalize Saturday into and focus on the feature, the Whitney, a Tour de Force coming out party for Arthur's Ride, and Bill Mott gets his Whitney. You know, one of those funny, you know, Hall of Famer anomalies that, you know, a race that, you know, you would think, well, sure, Bill Mott's probably won two or three of them. Well, it just so happens this was the first, and obviously this is a big addition. This is a huge addition, frankly, to the handicap division. Good timing, obviously, good time to force yourself into the picture, and the win and you're in and all that. And you know, there's a tappet that really one thing. you know, not that everybody is a paddock analyst, you know, horse flesh analyst, but even the most basic observers of horse flesh were, I did see that later Saturday night and yesterday, how many people, you know, pre-race too, not, you know, and I guess probably some after the race, but the people saying, oh my God, look at this horse. This Arthur's ride is just gorgeous. And he is. He took money late, was hovering, I think around 10, 11 to 1. And he was 8 to 1, and he was lower in the multis. And then, you know, took a couple of late pops to end up at 7 to 1. So pays 1580, which is a handsome return. And, you know, the other horses that were major considerations, National Treasure just, you know, was blah and, you know, never looked. I mean, it was kind of chasing, and everybody was chasing, essentially. I don't know if you watch back, you'll see that Junior Alvarado, who was having a fabulous summer, Alvarado really, after getting the lead, after, you know, really from the 11, you know, the left a couple of slots further inside, but, you know, still was a wide, you know, was widely drawn and manages to get the lead with not a tremendous amount of effort. And when, you know, when the 23-1, 46-3 went up, and you saw the way he was going, and I think Frank even, I'm trying to think about the call, I think Frank even remarked, and you could see everybody else was having to at least ask a little bit just to keep up with him. And, you know, when they got to the top of the stretch and, you know, Arthur's Ride had you know, jumped out, I love that kind of ride. When you're traveling comfortably and then, you know, the jock leans forward and smooches and, you know, the leader suddenly is three in front, and everybody else panics because they've already, you know, asked their horse to keep up. And it was a romping win for Arthur's Ride. And from the ownership side, the Glassmans, and biggest win, and got to be thrilled. And yeah, you know, that obviously that Belmont weekend performance, you know, which, you know, you still want a horse to back it up, right? And that he did, unchallenged. And, you know, you look at the chart and you see Skippy Longstocking and National Treasure ending up fifth and sixth. And horses like Croupy and Post Time and even Disarm, who were sixth, ninth, and tenth, seventh, eighth, and ninth at the second call, you know, they end up second, third, and fourth. So First Mission didn't show up and didn't get bet. That was the first indication. First Mission just, you know, ended up behind National Treasure. Bright Future. Bright Future, really, no impact. Went off basically the same price as Arthur's Ride. But for Croupy and Post Time, Croupy, this is a big performance to get this kind of placement. Very, very important. And it, you know, for as long as it took Croupy to find himself, and you know, it's only August of his 4-year-old year. And you know, he's now got the Suburban win, the grade two win, and he's now got multiple grade one placings. So the resume continues to build for Croupy, and Irad rode him for everything to get second. If you go back and watch, to get got past post time. Post time ran great. And it's funny, I was playing Saturday. I guess I could morph into an overall conversation about the difficulties on Saturday, and it was. It really, obviously, exasperating and exhausting. We're going to talk about it actually first and principally in about 10 minutes. Dr. Palmer will join us. And, of course, Dr. Palmer is the equine medical director in New York. And this, the decision to take the races, the two first of all, taking everything off the turf. At first, they were hoping, you certainly understood, the first decision making to take the non-stakes off of the turf. Okay, fine. But then came, later and quite a bit later, past 11:30, the decision not just to take the lure, the non-graded stake off the turf, but to also cancel the two graded turf races and to incorporate them into next Saturday, the Troy and the Saratoga Derby. So that, as it happens, I was home and making adjustments and having, you got to rebuild, your playmaking and everything, and then of course, when it comes to a race like the Lord, there's going to be connections making decisions to come on, to stay in or to come out. So it was one of those yo-yo type mornings. I knew right away there'd be, all kinds of questions and consternation and for everybody, for players, for Connections fans, who are looking forward to the day. But then before the Whitney and after, talked to both Dave O'Rourke and to Dr. Palmer. And I said to Dave, I'm sorry you had to go through this. And he, Dave is stoic about these kinds of difficulties and understand that all of the decision making, and of course the release, last week actually, just last week, of the 2023 incident review that Dr. Palmer helmed. So it comes in the shadow and in direct recollection of last summer's two high profile day difficulties, so, and fatalities. So Dr. Palmer, after the race, and Dave O'Rourke had said to me, there's a lot more that went into this. This was really, we incorporated into the decision-making process some of the elements of this report and the review that was issued last week. And then subsequently, after Arthur's ride, after he was coronated and sent home, I ended up talking to Dr. Palmer for 15 minutes. And he explained the intricacies of this moisture content evaluation system. And I right away, I said to him, can you come on and explain this? I said, because people, people are going to make assumptions about how these decisions were made. Oh, and they just, last minute. And he said, absolutely. So Scott Palmer will join us. Dr. Palmer, who is as responsible as anybody for the outstanding progress that's been made. The things we talked to Lisa Lazarus about Thursday. And Heisa on the tail end of what has been a decade, more than a decade, of tremendous advancement in keeping horses out of harm's way, because that's what all of this is. So yesterday on Loose on the Lead, and by the way, I don't do this too often, but I will tell you that you really would enjoy. I'll put a link up to the Capital OTB YouTube page. We had a Dave Hill was in town with his wife Katie, and so I took advantage of having Dave on TV with us yesterday. And then Dave Groening was going to be on, but he got tied up. So he ended up with Bruce Levine, who's got a very busy week, and actually won at Laurel yesterday, too. But I had Bruce Levine as one guest and Dave Hill as the second guest. And it, you want to watch something, you know, really interesting. Watch Bruce and Dave. Dave, you know, Bruce talked about, and we asked Bruce about some, you know, not, I don't want to call them thorny subjects, but, you know, some of the realities of being a, you know, a smaller or a medium-sized outfit, and what goes into, you know, keeping your, you know, keeping your shingle up, as it were. So Bruce was fabulous. And for those that don't realize, Bruce Levine's won 2,200 races, 2,200 plus. And then Dave, you know, we did some hot spring stuff and you know, parallels to Saratoga, and then it morphed into, you know, all the different things that Dave, you know, brings to any conversation. And he is in the process of doing the last of a series in Rolling Stone on the gambling landscape and the sports betting landscape in the country right now. And Dave has been going to all of the various, not just sports betting, but gambling conferences that dot the landscape, and has some really revealing thoughts on where things are. Because for those that, you know, for those that are amongst the sky is falling, sports betting is going to strangle us and is going to drown us, you can stop worrying about that, because the sports gambling situation, not so rosy for the sports betting operators. And Dave's got the finger on the pulse of that, and it's really interesting. And I encourage, he says they're already looking for an exit strategy, and basically moving on to try to attain iCasino licenses, because they're not making any money in the sports betting arena, and basically they're not letting you, the potential sports bettor, they're not letting you win any money. If you're any good, they shut you off and clamp you down and limit you. It's a joke. It's absolutely comedic. And you know, for those of, you know, for those of us that, you know, we already know that we've got a, you know, a difficult pricing strategy, pricing structure when it comes to takeout, you know, to beat, it's very hard. Well, the takeout with the taxes that the states have, you know, have established, it's worse in the sports betting landscape. So I really encourage you to watch, and I can have the conversation. I'll have the, you know, we'll have an NFL season kickoff conversation soon with Dave, kind of a preseason thing, and we can revisit it. But if you want to hear some very interesting thoughts, Dave Hill, just terrific. And then look for the next series in September of his you know, year long work at Rolling Stone. I mean, Dave Hill's a treasure. So anyway, I veered off into that, but I did. I don't often flog, you know, loose on the lead, Seth and I. But this one, I mean, they're all fun. I mean, and we make them. We aim to make them fun. So this one, particularly worth your time. So anyway, in the opening of that, I kind of went into a, you know, little bit of a focus on, you know, what I called a new reality, and you know, these kinds of decisions, and having to, you know, whether it's at Santa Anita and their policy that's been established about basically canceling after heavy rains. I mean, this all has to do with what Dick Powell talks about in the sealed tracks, and you know what kind of effect that has on the horses subsequently, not so much the day of. The sloppy track, not that a sealed sloppy track is any bargain per se, but it's subsequently. I mean, before everything dries out and they can get the harrows, you know, and dig up and freshen and, you know, create a nice safe cushion again. So we've got something actually to address about Sunday on that topic. But you know, we can't tear our hair out and stomp our feet when things like this are occurring. The cancellation of days, the, you know, the races coming off the turf, whatever it is, you know, moving these races. I mean, there's some questions about moving the races that will come up. Not that Dr. Palmer, that's not his arena. That's something, you know, for Andrew Offerman maybe and you know, the racing department to talk about and management. But when it comes to, you know, the process and the decision-making about the quality and the condition of the course, you know, there's going to be this new protocol, and Dr. Palmer will join us momentarily to address it. So I wanted to make that the priority this morning because I knew that people, you know, wanted to, we're going to want to know and want to hear about how this decision was made and, you know, the whys and wherefores. And there's a lot of moving parts. I mean, I kind of listened wide-eyed to Dr. Palmer about it. So, and actually, Brian, I don't think I gave you Dr. Palmer's number. So as I do that, and yeah, Brian can't raise him on the phone without without the number. But as we do that, let me get a couple of the other elements. Mig Leiter and Lafitte Pincai III, LP3, the great LP3. And we'll be able to, as part of our visit with LP, we will be congratulating him on he's on the ballot again this year for the Jim McKay Award, National Turf Writers and Broadcasters. He and Todd Trupp and Mike Penna are the three finalists that the writers and broadcasters are voting on. And obviously any of the above would be outstanding honorees. And actually, it's sort of a process. most appear on these ballots a few times. I was on the ballot, I don't know, maybe 3 years, three or four, before getting over the top. So at some point, all three will be recognized with the Jim McKay Award. There are a couple of elements of this I do want to get back to. Most notably, the Mr. Fitz, you know, for exemplifying the spirit of racing, and the Joe Palmer, which is service to the industry, the Walter Haight, the great writer award, and this year, there's also sometimes a a specialty, but not being it's not always awarded, and it's not going to be this year. Anyway, I want to go through all 12 of the finalists and say a couple things about each of them. And then some horsemen. Now, of course, there's a lot of guys and gals over on the sales grounds this morning. I was going to go over, and then at the last minute, about 8, I said, you know what? This thing with Dr. Palmer, and I got a couple of people from the West Coast that we want to get to, and Midwest. So I'm going to stay put and do it from here. All right. I think maybe tomorrow we'll go over after day one. We got to get a sale preview in, obviously, as well. All right. A couple of the other notes from the rest of the weekend, certainly on Friday, Cinderella's Dream. You knew that she would overwhelm that Oaks for Appleby with William Buick. McCulloch came running in the Glens Falls. And yesterday, how about the Queen's MG? You knew that she was in the Adirondack. You knew that she was, you know, one of the ones. But wow, to absolutely demolish that group, and the group looked good. The group looked A-okay, actually. There hasn't been, the figs have been a little, the Sunday figs have been slow to materialize this morning. There was next, I mean, Doug Cowens, he's going to start getting, I think, more and more pressure to run into a little higher company. I think the drums are beating for him to show up in the Breeders' Cup Classic, but you know what Doug told us when we spoke last, that you know he's going to keep to these marathons. He was spectacular winning the Birdstone. With that lure, by the way, staying on the being run and moving to the main track, Linda Rice is just smarter than everybody else. I know that doesn't sit well, that people would rather, you know, attack her and smear her at every opportunity. The fact that she saw the opportunity to enter Film Star as an MTO, yeah, in the lure and then, you know, win easily. Yeah, that was pretty clever. And then, of course, Ways and Means. What about Ways and Means? Gets the grade one win. Takes the test. So that was the Saratoga overview. We got a ton to do at Ellis. We'll talk to Tony Kahlo later, see if Tony can't produce another $45 winner. they don't grow on trees, but we'll try. But we got to go through all the preview races. And I suppose, Dr. Palmer is joining us now, It's got nothing to do with New York, but thoughts go out to Mrs. Benoit and the team at Britlin and Shane Wilson and his staff, because, of course, overcharged the absolutely fabulous mare went wrong on Saturday and couldn't be saved. And so thoughts go out to Mrs. Benoit, first and foremost, and to Ova herself. Mrs. Benoit easily could have taken her off the racetrack after last year, but they continued on, and she, right now, I mean, she's got the top performance figure in the sport, the 113 buyer from earlier in the year. So that was just brutal. And obviously, dampened a lot of the good racing at Ellis over the weekend. We'll go over it in a little bit. Right now, Dr. Palmer joins us. Dr. Palmer, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. And I talked yesterday on Loose on the Lead, started the
the show, Seth and I, with, you know, a conversation point about what transpired on Saturday. Here getting the show going, I explained that, you know, I had spoken to Dave O'Rourke before the Whitney, and then you absolutely fascinated me after the Whitney, and, you know, there's plenty for us to talk about, given that last week you released, the Gaming Commission released the review of the 2023 incidents and fatalities, and there's a lot that is involved with the you know, the summaries and the recommendations. But what you told me on Saturday about the moisture content consistency approach was fascinating, and I thought it was imperative that you explain to, you know, stakeholders and horse players and fans what this new process entails, and you know how it's going to, how it worked on Saturday and how it's going to work going forward.
Well, that's great, Steve. It's great to be back, Steve. I think the last time we spoke was 12 years ago after the New York Task Force report came out, and it's good to be back, so thank you for having me.
Not at all.
I wanted to put this report in context for a minute. The report is a public document, and it's available to anybody. You can get it off the commission website at gaming.ny.gov under the news section if you'd like to take a look at it. In terms of putting this in context, back in that day we talked about risk management, and risk management is a major effort in New York, has been for the last decade or so, to try to reduce fatalities in New York, and in so doing we've reduced the fatalities in New York by over 50% since the days of the aqueduct investigation. I think that the core understanding, though, about what is risk management and how does it apply to horse racing is basically that you go through a process where you do an investigation, you figure out, first of all, what happened, and then you basically design interventions to keep it from happening again. Then you monitor those interventions and then keep moving forward as new interventions come up or are necessary, because there's new risk factors that came into play. And that's basically what happened in 2023, that we had a very robust risk management program in place in 2023 at Saratoga, but we had an extraordinary increase in the number of racing fatalities that year. And the challenge, of course, was why? What happened? How come we had all those fatalities, exercise fatalities, in the face of a rigorous risk management program? And basically, that's what led to the development of this recent report, this recent survey, because and the findings and conclusions are all laid out in there. We certainly don't need to go over all that. But one of the important ones was the discovery of a new risk factor. And for many, many years, people have been puzzled about the possible association of moisture in the racetrack with injury. And there's been a lot of research done over the last 20 years with conflicting findings. Some people found evidence that it was an association, and other people found evidence that there was no association. Well, that challenge is partly because anytime you do a statistical analysis of data to look for associations between a factor and an outcome, the challenge is if you have very few outcome results. In other words, we've had so few, honestly, they're as devastating as they are, and thank God they're rare. But the fact is that because they're a rare event, it makes research around those challenges quite difficult. And also, rain or moisture variation was something that we really didn't have a good handle on. We didn't have good metrics to look at that up until recently. And we pretty much just looked at rainfall and said, well, you know, it wasn't associated. If it rained, they had fatalities. If it didn't rain, there were fatalities. So there was no good correlation with that. And come to appreciate that rainfall itself is not a good metric to look at if you're trying to find out if moisture in the racetrack is associated with fatalities. So NYRA has been pioneering a lot in terms of things like measurement, using numbers to get information, to make an objective data to get decisions that are appropriate and realistic and not just based on individual bias by anybody. And so that there are moisture sensors underneath the turf courses at Saratoga, and then there's a device that's used on both courses to go around the course and measure the moisture in the cushion of those racetracks and measure it at multiple locations. So one of the things that we've done over the years, we've looked at this moisture business as kind of an average, the average moisture compared to one year to another. And it's been a common finding that a team of investigators might come in and say, well, you know what, the average rainfall or the average moisture in the racetrack even from this year is no different than last year. And therefore, they say that the moisture doesn't have anything to do with fatalities. And in truth, that's a problem because the moisture doesn't come on a regular basis, and you can't use averages to compare one period of time to another period of time. There's specific statistical tests that we can do to address that, but typically we haven't done that in the past. Well, I spent a lot of time after the incident last year at Saratoga doing research on these moisture issues and came up with some interesting findings working with Mick Peterson from the Racing Surface Testing Laboratory. I asked Mick if he would please not just give me the average number of moisture in the racetracks, but if he'd give me the moisture every single day. And he did. So we looked at a daily moisture content of the racetrack, and we charted it out with something called a box and whisker plot, which basically not only tells you if there is temporal variation, that is, from day to day, did we have more moisture in the racetrack on one day than another, it also tells us, did we have more moisture in some part of the racetrack? With those five sensors around the racetrack, we could say, well, the moisture was different at different sections, or it wasn't. Now, the fundamental concept about a safe racetrack is it needs to be consistent. A consistent racetrack is a safe racetrack. An inconsistent racetrack is a racetrack that can increase the risk for injury. And there are three properties of a racetrack, Steve, that can come into play here. The one is geometry. That is the shape of the racetrack and the grade on the turns and the straightaways. And that's a pretty stable situation. Once that's been set and evaluated properly, it doesn't really change much during the meet. The next piece of information, the next component of the racetrack, is really the composition of the surface itself. And that is basically sand. It's 85 to 90% sand and about 10 to 15% silt and clay. Now, that recipe, if you will, needs to be correct, and it is, and they measure it at the beginning of every meet, and it's something that also can change dramatically the consistency of a racetrack. The third factor is moisture. Now, moisture is the most obvious variable that can change from hour to hour on a racetrack, and it certainly can change from one part of the racetrack to another depending upon how much moisture is in there. Now, the moisture that's in the racetrack is a function of not just rainfall or water truck application. It's also a function of that composition we just talked about and how absorptive that composition is. Some racetrack surfaces are different from others, and because of the particle composition is different. And those absorptive qualities determine how much moisture hangs around in that track once it's applied to it. And then you have the drainage issues, of course, too, which are very important. How does the water drain out of the racetrack? So it's a very dynamic process that we have to look at. And what we found last year, interestingly, was that there were significant variations in the moisture of the racetrack, not only temporal variations. In other words, the moisture in the racetrack during last year's Whitney weekend, if you will, and the Travers weekends was very much higher than the rest of the meet. So we knew that there was an increased volume of moisture in those clusters of injuries that happened surrounding the Whitney weekend and the Travers weekend. And so looking at that, what we did, we charted all that, and then we also found that under the turf course, we didn't have the ability at that time to measure spatial variation, but we did have the ability to measure temporal variation. So we had some moisture data last year from the turf. We had even better moisture data from the dirt. And with all that in mind, what we could do is we could identify, using the appropriate statistics, that there was a definite increase in risk on those days in which the moisture content was higher than it normally would be, and also when there was extensive variation of the moisture content around the racetrack. For example, last year we found that the front stretch of the dirt track had a great deal much more moisture, at least 25% more moisture in it than the back stretch did on the days when the fatalities occurred. And if you'll remember, if you think about the dirt fatalities, they all happened in the front stretch of the racetrack, every one of them. All of the racing dirt fatalities happened between the 1/8th pole and the 15th, 16th pole. So, and all of these fatalities were fetlock breakdown injuries, pretty much. There was about 92% were fetlock breakdown injuries. And that is a common injury, but typically in New York it's about 50%, not 92%. So the fact that we had so many of those types of injuries, which are fatigue-type injuries, and that so many of them happened, or all of them happened in the front stretch at the finish line or right after the finish line, there's a pretty strong correlation between those moisture content findings and the location of the injuries last year. So with that in mind, we took that data and used it as a benchmark to say, if we see these kinds of situations again, the same moisture contents, the same differences around the racetrack, we know that that racetrack then is going to represent an increased risk for injury. So that could, we didn't know for sure if it would be consistent from year to year. So what I did was during the Belmont Festival up here at Saratoga, I got together with the track maintenance folks and we took all those moisture measurements and did it even a little better than we did last year and used that as a baseline so that when we came back in the middle of July for the Saratoga meet, we had relevant data that was consistent with the time and place. The track surface is the same. The weather conditions were similar. And so we had a current baseline to work with to see if things would change in a way that the track could become an increased risk factor. So what happened on Saturday was early in the day, we did all our moisture measurements, and then we compared the moisture measurements of the turf course from 2023 with the moisture measurement of the turf course in 2024. And what we found was that there was actually more moisture in the racetrack in 2024, last Saturday, than there was in 2023. And because of that, that represented an inconsistency of the surface that was a challenge for us. If you look at that report from last year, all of the turf fatalities occurred when the moisture in the racetrack was above 26% by volume. And the numbers the other day were 28 to 30%. So because of that, and because the conditions were similar, even worse than they were in 2023, the decision was made that we should take those races off the turf and in the interest of horse safety. And so that's why the turf races were moved, and that's the reasoning behind it. And we also looked at the dirt course, and even though the dirt course of the main track had a fairly high amount of moisture, and it was similar to what it was in 2023, except that the consistency was so much better. And in 2023, if you look at this part of the racetrack that was the most dry and compared to the part that was most wet, there was a 62% difference between those two measurements. And on Saturday, that difference was only 7%. So we figured that even though the moisture content was fairly high, the track was consistent enough that horses would not be exposed to the inconsistency, which can lead to the challenges of footing and such. And so we decided to let the dirt go ahead. All the dirt races, of course, went as they did, and we had a very successful racing day. So that's, in a nutshell, Steve, what happened there, and I'm excited to say that we have these new tools to look at, and this is an evolving process. We're looking at this stuff, and the more data we get, the more accurate we're going to be in these predictions. But we use what we have. One of my favorite expressions, Steve, is in research, is to say, if I only knew then, you know, what I know now. It's so true, and so we're taking the stuff that we know now, and we're using it to prevent the things that happened before, and that's our responsibility, Steve. That's the way we continue to make progress and reduce fatalities, and we saw it in action here during the Whitney weekend. And so it was a very exciting opportunity to do that, and I'm happy to have a chance to visit with you about it and answer any questions that you may have.
Well, and there's obviously plenty of questions, and some may be more appropriately directed toward the racing office and the racing department, in terms of some of the logistics. But from a, from a technical standpoint, on your end, I first of all was sort of not alarmed, but I when you shifted the conversation Saturday from the turf course variance to the main track, in the back of my mind, I was thinking there was a chance that if there's a if there's a measurement variable, then you might have canceled the whole card. Is that an appropriate conclusion?
Well, Steve, it is. And I say that because, and that's why we measure them both, and that's why we critically evaluate them both, and we do it independently. But I mean, what we found, if we would have found that the conditions on the turf course would have been inconsistent the way they were last year, then I would have recommended we just call the whole day.
Well, you mean the main track, not that you said turf course, but you mean if there had been inconsistencies of the same variance, then you could have. You could have scrapped the day.
Yes, I could have scrapped the day. Now, the thing of it is, Steve, you know, that has consequences. I'm well aware of that. But I was not willing to take the risk that we could have the same thing happen this year that happened last year. That just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Period.
Well, and I know that you said that to the Saratoga Special. And this is also I don't know if it's a thorny question. Who's the arbiter, the final arbiter of these decisions, Scott?
Well, NYRA has a role. If NYRA, and it's happened before, you've seen races or race days be canceled due to weather, right?
Sure.
Okay. The state also has a role. The state role, the stewards, the state steward in particular. If there is a determination that the conditions are unsafe, the state steward will stop racing. And you've seen that happen before, too,
sure.
Mostly in cases of lightning and severe weather, right? And so in terms of the final arbitrator, I suppose it really boils down to the state authority, but in terms of emergent measures, that is. But, you know, certainly that's the most inconvenient of all interventions because, you know, if the weather is predicted to be terrible and NYRA can say, we're just not going to run this weekend, that can be done up front and everybody is saved the inconvenience of, you know, putting everything together for that racetrack to happen. I would share with you one other circumstance that's somewhat similar. In 2015, I developed a heat management program, excessive heat management program, looking at the heat index. And this was based upon the National Weather Service recommendations for human beings. And remember, every time we send a horse out in a racetrack, there's a human being on top of it. And if the federal government says you should not have people outside doing exercise under these certain conditions, then I am not going to send the jockeys out there to ride in those days, period. So what happened was, I guess it was maybe, it might have been the same year or the year after, but we've got a weather station in the infield of every racetrack, NYRA racetrack, and we monitor things like heat index at 15-minute intervals all the time. And so we're watching the heat index, and in the morning down at Belmont that morning, it was 85 was heat index. And the recommendations that we made is if it gets to 100, then we have a meeting. We meet with the racing officials, we meet with the jockeys, we meet with the trainers, we talk about what we think we might want to do, and basically there are preventive things that we can put in place, which means ice around the and buckets around the racetrack, cold water hosing, timing the racing intervals, monitoring the horses carefully before and after the races, things like that, just to keep a close eye on the situation. But if the heat index goes above 105, we cancel racing. That was the standard we've used. That only happened once. And it happened at Belmont, and the heat index was 85 all morning long, and it slowly started to climb up a little bit, and 10 minutes before post time, it went to 106. 10 minutes before post time, we called it off. Now, that created quite a bit of inconvenience, as you can well imagine, and it's regrettable. But by the same token, you know, we have to have some objective data to make these decisions, and sometimes it's going to be inconvenient, Steve. But nobody dies, right? And that's the bottom line. And so I regret any inconvenience that happens from these decisions or these arbitration decisions, if you want to call it that, or, you know, in horse racing, because I fully appreciate the consequences. But the consequences of ignoring what we know now and letting something happen again is just unforgivable. There's absolutely no excuse for that. So that's really where we are with this kind of a decision-making process. Now, could we have made that decision earlier in the day on Saturday? You know what? It took a little time to get all the data together and do the calculations and do the comparisons and consult with Dr. Peterson and such. This process is going to be automated. We're working on it today. We're having another conference call about that to make this happen much earlier in the day so we can, before the LASIK is given, before everybody's at the racetrack. You know, there's obvious, you know, advantages to doing this as early as we can. But it's, we've got to get the data first to make that happen, and we're going to take steps to make it better. But this was the first time this has ever been done, and it maybe wasn't the best timing and maybe the best way to roll it out, but and it could have been a little confusing, I admit, but I think that it'll be better next time, and it keeps getting better. That's that iterative process, that we try and do things better and better and better as time goes on, and we'll never be perfect, but we keep trying to be, and that's the best we can do, and that makes for progress.
Dr. Scott Palmer joining us, and, of course, New York's equine medical director. And as I said earlier this morning, Dr. Palmer referring back to the New York task force that basically has been the template. You've heard Alan Foreman talk about this, the template for all of the successful implementation of safety measures. That's the taproot mayor of everything that and you know, it's interesting. This is sort of a bookend conversation, Dr. Palmer, because Lisa Lazarus was with us on Thursday, and we followed up on the second quarter numbers that HISA released. And you know, I am always quick to, you know, talk about the Mid-Atlantic program that Alan instituted, that, you know, has had wider spread application around the game. And all of this has frankly put you know, the American racing statistics below the rest of the world. And I always couch these kinds of conversations by saying we can't talk about you know, fatality statistics, you know, per thousand as a marketing gimmick. You just appreciate the work that's gone into the effort and the results it's getting, and you move on and continue to try to make it better. A few more elements of what you're laying out for people, and I want to. I've got a dirt question and I've got a turf question. I think the dirt is more complicated, so we'll make that second. When it comes to the turf, the moisture content, I mean, what about it is dangerous? What about the moisture and the, you know, the variability of the going enhances the risk factor exactly? Because, you know, certainly in Europe, you know, they race on heavy and soft going as a matter of course. Is there anything about our turf that is different, and what makes it dangerous if there's that variability in moisture content?
Okay. Now, that's a great question, Steve. And I think it's both the turf and the dirt are complicated in this regard. When you're getting down, we're doing a deep dive here for a moment. And it's a very important thing to understand the nuances of these surfaces and how they behave when horses are galloping over them. Now, I want you to think just for a minute, if you were driving down Route 87 at 65 miles an hour and you come to exit 13, you want to get off on 13 North to come up to the racetrack, there's a yellow sign there by the side of the road. I think it says 40 miles an hour. It might be a third. I think, let's say it's 40. That sign was put there by an engineer when they built that highway, with the idea that you, if you try to negotiate that turn at high speed, there are going to be problems. And the problem is that when you're going down a straight highway, the vector forces of your acceleration are in a straight line. As soon as you change, you start to turn, the acceleration increases, even if the speed doesn't increase. And so your acceleration vectors are going up, and when you come around that turn, the tendency is for your vehicle to slide off the highway to the outside, if you will, as you're making it outside the radius of the turn. Now, if you slow down, then that centripetal force doesn't have such a great effect. And it's actually being counteracted by gravity a little bit. In other words, it's the force of gravity that keeps your car on the road, pressing down on your car, pressing down on your tires, pressing down on the macadam. Now, you make the turn, and you're fine. Now, what happens, Steve, if there's a rainstorm, and we know there's a little bit of an oil slick on these roads, and the rain first comes down, and that turn becomes slippery? I'm sure you can appreciate that the risk of your car sliding off the highway goes up. And how about if it's icy? How about in the wintertime, you make that turn in the ice? You've completely lost the gravitational resistance, and you're going to slide right off that highway if you go in that turn too fast. So what we're seeing when we get into the turns of the racetrack is the centripetal forces are present that are not present in the straightaways. Now, what I'm telling you here is all hypothesis right now, Steve, but it's the best I can do with the information that we have at hand. Now, we also know that the horse's gallop has got three phases to it. There's a hind limb stance phase where the horse is loading those hind limbs like gigantic springs, compressing them down and into the surface, and then they spring off of that and then land on their front legs. And there are jerk forces. That's just a physics name for the forces, the vibration forces that happen when you contact the surface. And they happen, and then the horse comes up off the front legs. There's a period of suspension, and they're back on the hind legs again. Well, during that hind limb stance phase, there's a time when there's only one hind limb on the ground.
Right.
And that hind limb has to hold all the weight of the horse and has to be stable. It has to be a stable platform in order for that horse to leap off of that one hind leg and move forward and complete the gallop in good order. Now, if that turn in the racetrack is wet enough, it's going to be more slippery. It's going to be more difficult to maintain that balance, to get that stability moving forward. And if you look at the report that I put out on Tuesday, you'll see there's a chart in there that charts the location of the dirt fatalities and the turf fatalities. It's not appropriate to put them all in the same basket and say, well, these fatalities happen all over the place, so therefore there is no association between the racetrack and these fatalities. If you separate them, you find that the dirt fatalities, all the dirt racing fatalities happened in the front stretch of the racetrack. There was one dirt fatality that happened during training. That horse was pulled up in the back stretch. We don't know exactly where that one happened. We know where all the other ones happened because they fell down. So the dirt happened in the straightaway, in the front straightaway. And when you think about that for a second, the why is that? Well, perhaps a major component of that is the wind and sun shadow of the grandstand of the racetrack. The clubhouse and the grandstand exerts a huge wind and sun shadow over that racetrack, especially in the afternoons. In the backstretch, there is no building. There are no big trees back there even. And so the backstretch is exposed to bright sunlight all hours of the day, and there's wind effect in the back. So the evaporation of moisture off the track is very different in the backstretch and the front stretch. Now, in the turf, it's a different animal. You've got plants growing out there. I think you'd appreciate that, Steve. You can't feel a turf racetrack, okay? So there's some very different characteristics of that surface that enter into its ability to absorb water, to manage water, to move water, and evaporate. So now just think, if we go back to the map again, if you look at the location for the turf fatalities, all of the turf fatalities last year in 2023 happened either going into a turn or in the turn. Now, that's something to think about because, okay, well, does that mean that centrifugal force had something to do with it? May well have. I can't prove it because there's no science that has ever measured that, but I believe that that's probably what's going on in the turf courses when they get more moisture in them than a certain threshold because it just becomes too slippery for them to safely negotiate the turns. Only a hypothesis, Steve, but that's the best I can do for you right now.
Does the crown or the banking have an influence?
Well, the straightaways on our racetracks here in New York are generally around 2 degrees grade, and the turns are about 4 degrees grade. So there is banking, and there should be banking. That's appropriate. But you know, again, this is a part of the art of building racetracks. I'm not aware of any data that says that a thoroughbred racetrack should be banked at 2, 3, 4, 10, 20 degrees. There's nothing out there to say that. But there's hundreds of years of experience running around a dirt racetrack, and I think that, a turf racetrack. So I believe that we have to give credit to that valuable, you know, hundreds of years of experience to say, well, maybe we've got it pretty close to being right. Should we change the grades? I don't know. I don't have any information to indicate that we should do that. But certainly there is a difference. But it's important to have that grade in terms of water drainage and in terms of at least in some, to some degree, counteracting the centrifugal forces that the horses and the riders are experiencing when they go through those turns.
I've got a particularly difficult. I'm going to talk about the dirt now, and then I want to distill it into a question that just occurred to me that is, I mean, as if people can't tell already the myriad of forces that are involved here, and you know all the moving parts. To turn to the dirt, Dr. Palmer. We've had extensive conversation, particularly with Dick Powell, about the history of sealed racetracks and the post-sealed racetrack effects, because the incidences of breakdowns post sealed surface, and you know, you've addressed this going back to the task force and California and you know the Santa Anita investigation as well, drew some very clear conclusions. Talk about sealed surfaces and then unsealing the track, dropping harrows and returning the track over, however long a period it takes to dry it, so that it's safe again. Because clearly, it's not just anecdotal. I mean, there's empirical evidence that these sealed racetracks are a huge problem. I without getting into point clear right this second, we lost a horse Sunday morning, post sealed racetrack. What some thoughts on this topic?
Well, I think it's complex, and I think we have to be careful not to overgeneralize or to use too broad a brush to talk about the risk associated with sealed racetracks. I mean, I think it's probably more appropriate, and we don't have the data to really dig into this. And again, there can be associations that come up statistically with things like this. And I think it varies from racetrack to racetrack. I think that, for example, I think in California, maybe you can help me with this, but it was my impression, at least at some period of time, they weren't allowed to run on a sealed racetrack.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Well, and even subsequently, they've limited the exposure of horses, the next morning after they've dried, and horses have to be, and this is actually part of your recommendation from last week, horses have to apply technically to, to work, to they
right,
can gallop,
right.
But to if they're going to have a timed workout, a high level energy exertion event, they
right.
have to. They have to be reviewed before they're allowed on the track, and it feels like we're heading in that direction.
Well, I think that my personal feeling about this probably boils down to change again, inconsistency. I think it all funnels back to the consistency issue, Steve, and the time frame. The temporal variability we just talked about of the moisture. Is very, very important. I think it also depends to some degree about when the tracks were sealed and how they were sealed. For example, they're not all the same. Like, let's say you have a big thunderstorm that comes in the middle of the race card, and we've all been there, and they run out there with the tractors and they seal the racetrack and run the floats around, and when you first turn out of the harrow yard with that equipment, the racetrack is got a given amount of moisture in it. Those tractors can't go fast. They can't go. I think it's something in 6 miles an hour is like their speed limit, So it takes some time for them to get around that racetrack. By the time you get around a mile of racetrack in a thunderstorm like that, the surface is very different by the time you get to the end point, right? And so what you're doing is you're sealing moisture into the racetrack when you do that. And then So that creates an inconsistency, like we talked about earlier, that's super, super important. But in a condition where you can seal the track before the weather gets bad, and that's they were able to seal that main track. We had some rain Friday evening, as you know, a lot of it. And the track was already sealed before that happened, and they put the dogs out, or the cones, if you will, were out so you couldn't breeze in the track within 25 feet of the rail. The question that we really don't have an answer to right now, Steve, is how long does it take for that racetrack consistency to stabilize in the event of a weather event? And whether it's sealing, whether you put pressure on it or don't put pressure on it, you know, obviously a track will... an open track will evaporate moisture better than a sealed track will. A sealed track, on the other hand, keeps moisture from getting into it in the first place. So it's from a track maintenance standpoint, one of the other things that I recommended in the report on Tuesday was that we take a new look at our best practices for managing moisture in the racetrack. And that includes, for the short term, using the guidelines that we have to determine whether there's enough risk involved, we're not comfortable with that risk, we're going to cancel racing. Or in the long term, are there ways that we can dry out these racetracks or make them more consistent in that period where the track is drying out? I can tell you that empirically, meaning that my impression over the years has been, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I think a lot of people feel that maybe the most dangerous part of the racetrack is not when it's in the middle of the storm, but when it's either when it's changing, when it's drying out is probably the more challenging part, because when do you allow people back on it? Should you not allow anybody back on that track until noontime the next day and not allow training? I mean, maybe that's an appropriate recommendation to do given the situation we had here on Sunday. But I think that we need to work on that, Steve. We need to get more data and make informed, good decisions about that. But I think that the question of how that track dries out is really, really important. For example, the moisture sensors that we have under the turf courses, the difference between the moisture over a period of 24 hours was not significantly different. Now, those moisture measurements, those devices are between 6 and 9 inches below the surface of the turf. And I think you can appreciate that if it's that deep, you wouldn't expect to see major variations from day to day. Now, over a day or two or three, yeah, but not in a 24-hour period necessarily. And that's what we found the other day, that between Saturday and Sunday, the moisture contents were very similar, that deep in the turf. However, there was a big difference in the consistency on the dirt between Saturday and Sunday. You know, it was much better than earlier. So it's one of these things where I think we need to gather data and make those decisions. I think it's a great, great question. It's a very important one. And I think that we just need to do some more research. My guess is that we're going to find out that we need to have close monitoring of the moisture on the surface of a dirt racetrack and monitor it in such a way that if the inconsistency is present, we wait until that consistency is better. I think also something that we may, it's a trend in the data, that we can tolerate more variation on a dry racetrack than we can on a wet racetrack, I mean a really wet one or a really dry one. So things like that are nuances of the work we're doing right now, Steve, and we just don't have all the data, but I wouldn't be surprised in another year that we will. One of the things we talked about doing yesterday that I think we're going to be able to have some success with is trying to get through HISA, get all of the racetracks in America doing this same measurement with the consistency and the repeated measures and monitoring. And I think if we can make that happen, it'll be sooner rather than later that we'll have the answer to your question, because we'll have thousands of racetrack measurements made in a very short period of time, and that's going to help us a lot make an informed decision about that. Right now there's a lot of opinion, and I think a lot of it's probably well-founded, but I think we need to get some data, and I think HISA is going to, if they will allow us to do the same thing at all the racetracks, we're going to make a huge step forward.
Dr. Palmer, the question that came to mind as you were elucidating regarding the turf and you know the turns and the banking and knowing I was going to bring up the dirt as the secondary element, it occurs to me, and because I talk about it a lot, the difference between turf horses and dirt horses as defined by the turnover of the feet and the mechanism in terms of dirt horses. You know, they slide on the dirt before they turn over, and turf horses not sliding. Their hooves, you know, they basically stick to the ground. And, you know, the difference between horses enjoying the footing and being challenged by the footing. I mean, horses will not, explaining it for years, horses have one great fear: falling down, because that's when a cougar pounces on them and kills them. They will not put out and not run at full strength, at full effort, if they're unsure about the footing. And I'm curious if the process of trying horses on different surfaces and moving them from turf to dirt, I don't want to say interchangeably. I mean, I talked to enough trainers to know, you know, how they, you know, they try horses on the two different surfaces, and of course the third different surface with synthetics. But yeah. I am curious if surface switches are being evaluated as part of, you know, each time you look at these fatalities. How many times have there been surface switches? Is that a, you know, a higher risk factor, you know, knowing that, you know, the beginning of meets when horses come in from other venues and, you know, this was part of the decision-making process of putting synthetic in at Belmont in the winter. The fact that that, you know, you're now able to install a very similar surface at Belmont as we have upstate. And so dirt horses in New York will basically be running on the same surface year round. So we know that, you know, that it's a positive. So I'm just curious if the movement back and forth from turf to dirt raises, you know, the specter of an incident more so than, you know, more so than, you know, making a decision about a horse that this is a turf horse and she's going to run on turf, and this is a dirt horse.
Well, your question is a great one, and I think there's a couple of things I'd like to mention. Let's just park the injury thing over in our waiting room for just a second, and let's talk about the changes, or the differences of how a horse moves on turf and on dirt. That'd be okay?
Do that? Yeah, of course.
Now, I think your observation is accurate. I think that it's a highly individual thing, you know, among horses, as you can well appreciate. That's part of the art of training horses, right, in terms of figuring out whether they're going to be more successful on the classic surfaces of turf and dirt. And that's an art of the, you know, it's an art more than a science, and I think trainers are really, really good at that for the most part. But one of the things that I think is a real potential help to make that decision that we'll find that is not quite ready for prime time, but I want to share it with you, is the use of wearable biometric sensors. These sensors are very sensitive, the ones that use accelerometers. There are different types of wearable sensors, but the ones that use accelerometers to measure three dimensions of acceleration during the horse's workout or during the race can tell us a lot about the surface. In other words, an individual horse, you might, in other words, if you took them out there on a dirt course and then on a turf course and had the sensor on this, and each time, you would probably see a difference in the horse's gait, because as you say, you know, it's different. It just is. And it's the surface tension thing. The surface tension of a turf course is very different from the surface tension of a cushioned racetrack, dirt racetrack. So it's not unreasonable to believe that we could use some kind of a device like that to help us make that call to see where the horse is most comfortable, because it stands to reason if he has a gait that is modified by the surface in such a way that it makes that horse uncomfortable, well, of course, you know, that's not the right surface for him, right? So those sensors are something I think are going to give us some information about that preference, if you will, that's going to be very fascinating to look at. I think that in terms of injuries, I'm only aware of one study that's been done so far, Steve, that looked at injuries, and they basically called it, you know, off the turf, you know, type stuff. And the data we have so far does not indicate that that's an increased risk for fatal musculoskeletal injury. Now, it's only one study, but there is that one. Now, the word research, Steve, it means we research. We do it again. You know, so I think that study needs to be repeated, maybe on a bigger basis. But I think that it's a great question. On the subject of surface changes, in the report I put out on Tuesday, you'll notice a section about surface changes. Do you remember how many surface changes we had last year at Saratoga?
Well, we had the wettest winter, wettest summer you could have imagined. So,
65 surface changes. The average number of surface changes at Saratoga for the previous 8 years or so was somewhere in the neighborhood of 30. You know, it varied a bit from year to year. I think in 2022 we had 15, something like that. So, I mean, it was incredibly different. And so I think we can use surface changes as a proxy measure for moisture in the turf. A proxy measure is something in science where you have some difficulty measuring it, the variable accurately. So you look for something associated with it and use that as a proxy measure. For example, the guy you got on the phone here today has got gray hair. Does that mean I'm at risk for heart disease? Well, not really. I hope not. But I would say, though, that because I am, you know, 74 years old, I expect that my level of risk is greater than a young fella. Okay? So that's an example of a proxy measure. So I think that surface changes are a very good proxy measure for moisture on a turf racetrack. And when we had the increase in fatalities that way, I think it's one more strong piece of evidence that moisture was partially responsible for those fatalities. So I know that I hope it's not a great answer to your question, but it's trying to give you the best information we have available to us to answer that question. And again, more data, Steve. When we get more data, to answer that question, we'll be more comfortable with the answer. But I can tell you that right now, as you know, most folks don't want to go from turf to dirt. I mean, they can make a decision, a tactical decision, to do that for whatever reason. But I think it's generally well known that it's not an easy transition for horses, and there's some challenges associated with it.
Well, in addition to, you know, what we've been discussing, Dr. Scott Palmer with us, New York State Gaming Commission, equine medical director for the state, and of course, long time. I'm not going to call you a figurehead. That's a bad. I don't mean it that way. Longtime contributor to all aspects of equine health considerations, not just in New York but around the game. And I suppose, in addition to the main conversation point was the moisture content evaluation program. We can also fold in for a couple of minutes some of the other elements of the report last week, Scott, because for those that haven't read it, it's 107 pages. The summary and the conclusions and the recommendations, will bring things together if anybody wants to, give it a review. There's quite a bit in here, and if you had to pick one or two of the elements that would have the greatest and most immediate impact, what would they be?
Well, the recommendations and the conclusions are, I'll just give your listeners a tip. When you download that file, in the table of contents, they're all hot linked. So it's really easy to get to where you want to go. For summary and conclusion, you just click the table of contents and take you right to it. So we're aware that navigation of that document is going to be a challenge. But anyway, getting back to your point, there were a number of recommendations. There were 17 altogether, but they were divided into three categories. One category was racing surface. The next category was veterinary services. And the third category was other. And these recommendations, in terms of ranking them in importance, they're complicated to do that because some of them are quick fixes, you know, some things we can do right away, and some things are going to take years to do, and some are super expensive and require a lot of investigation and research resources. But I think probably the quickest thing, the most important quick thing, is what we talked about this morning in terms of improved measurement of moisture in the racetrack, improved classification of surfaces. You know, when we get the classification of racing surfaces every day, that's a subjective opinion by some the people that are working at the track there, and it's terrific. I mean, I got no argument with it except to say that it's subjective. And because it's subjective, it leaves room for interpretation that is important, but it shouldn't be the only thing we use. I strongly recommend that they use numerical values since we have them. In Japan, for example, they rate their racetracks, they classify the racetracks according to the percent moisture content, and that's it. Now, I think it's important to have a human element involved with it, but I think basically changing over from a classification that's completely subjective to one that's based on significant numerical changes, I mean, I think that's really a huge and important thing, not only for the handicappers, but also for the researchers, so that we can make more accurate associations between classification of the racetrack and injury. Because right now, it's a little bit up in the air in terms of that classification. It's a biased situation. I think that re-examining our best practices for managing a wet racetrack is really important, and I had some recommendations there. I think that's super important. I think that there's a recommendation under the surface there that we put a synthetic surface at Saratoga. And now I fully realize there's loads of concerns involved with that decision, but I got to tell you, if we had a synthetic surface there, we probably would not have had the same kind of fatalities because synthetic surface drains so much faster, incredibly fast. And so managed properly, we would have been running on the synthetic surface instead of the dirt for a lot of it and probably would have been, you know, in much better shape. So I think it's an important one, but that's not going to happen overnight. But I think it's important that we do it. Vet services-wise, there are a number of them there that I think are important. I think having an increased scrutiny of horses before high-speed exercises is critical. And there's challenges associated with that. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, and right now there's basically a house rule, Naira, that the horses have to be looked at by their attending veterinarians between 72 and 24 hours of a race. That's a financial burden, okay, to have a veterinarian come look at your horse every time it runs. By the same token, the work out in California, I think, has shown that it's really super important to do that. We can it can be part of reducing fatalities, and it's really, really important. In the area of high-speed exercise during training, breezing, if you will, you know, we might do 15,000 races in a year in Naira. There's probably, you know, I think there's probably 400,000 horses out on the training track in the morning. They're not all breezing, but there's like 50,000 breezes. I mean, so again, it's not practical. We don't have enough veterinarians to do that, to examine every horse before it breezes. So in consultation with some trainers and veterinarians, I think the commission has changed its recommendation. We had a recommendation to do that last year. We pulled that back. And the new rulemaking says that only if a horse has ever been on the vet's list for unsoundness, it needs to be examined by a veterinarian before it goes out and does any high-speed work. Now, that's only a few. That's a lot smaller number. Instead of doing all of them, we're trying to highlight the most important ones, the ones that are at the greatest risk. And horses that have been on the vet's list for unsoundness are very high risk for injury. So that's a really, really important. It could be done right away. I think that's a big deal. I think that increased reporting to HISA, you know, if you think back, it's kind of an ironic situation. In the task force report in 2012, we made a point that we need to get better reporting and medication treatments. It was hard to get medication records and such, and we needed to have better injury reporting, non-fatal injury reporting. These are things that folks are not so easy to comply. They don't really want to comply with that to some degree, and that has to be changed. And with HISA's capability of having this huge database with medication treatments in it and non-fatal injuries, we're going to get a whole lot more information in a hurry and be a whole lot better at protecting horses in terms of use of medication and in terms of knowing what's going on out there on our racetracks beyond fatalities. Super important. So improved compliance and reporting is really, really important from the veterinary standpoint. Standardized necropsy protocols. We had some inconsistency there. We've addressed that at Cornell University, so I think we're good in that part's already done. The wearable sensors. wearable sensors are so important, and it's a very challenging situation right now because there's controversy about who owns the data, for example. Like in the NFL, they were sensors, and who owns that data? Does the player own that data? Does the NFL own that data? Does the team own that data? And right now, there's a lot of lawyers who are looking at this, and it's a hugely controversial issue, and we need to get that sorted out so we can get sensors on these horses as soon as possible. Now, the good news is the AEP Racing Committee, which I'm a member, we put out a research proposal request, and we've got some very good companies have submitted proposals, and we'll have them doing a standardized study in 2025. We won't have those numbers till 2026, and by that time, we hope to have a recommendation of a sensor that really does a great job of predicting what's going on. Right now, it's not immediately clear that, well, there's some of them already got some data that's really good, but it's not really clear relative to say that, well, this one's better than that one. And so we're trying to get that all sorted out for the industry in the coming year. So that's a time-sensitive thing, but it's super important. There's some other really important things that can be done in terms of the trainer access to risk factors. For years, I've been telling trainers, well, you need to train a horse with high risk factors. Risk factors are cumulative. The horse got a lot of risk factors, then you need to train that horse a little differently than others. The challenge is, a trainer would say to me, well, how do I find out what those risk factors are, and how do I find out if they apply to my horse? And right now, HISA has developed a new risk factor database, and they're using artificial intelligence to rank these things. That process needs to be validated by an epidemiologist and by some veterinarians to make sure it's accurate. When that thing is right, that database should be made available to trainers. So, for example, there could be a password-protected portal that says, well, Steve Bick has got five horses. Well, he's got access to all these risk factors for those five horses. If the horse changes hands, then the new trainer, the new owner, gets access to those risk factors. So providing the ability for trainers to really know what their horses are doing in terms of risk is super important. That's a really big one. And I think that one of the other things that I put in there that some people are going to look at that and say, wow, I don't even know why that's in here. But there's this whole section, a recommendation there on something called design thinking. And design thinking is not, again, it's not maybe immediately apparent how that's relative to horse racing, but design thinking came about in the 1960s at Stanford University at the request of industry like IBM, like Ford Motor Company, et cetera, because it was at that time when these companies were very interested in learning about what the American public, the evolving post-war American, the baby boomer crowd and all that, what are they interested in, what do they need, what do their households need, you know, what are they looking for in terms of refrigerators and cars and such. And what these Stanford guys got together and they said, well, we can design a process called design thinking where you can come up with the best ideas as a group in terms of how many people you need in the conversation, in terms of how you conduct the conversation. And basically, it's that same iterative process where you empathize. You say, well, what's the goal? Our goal is to reduce fatalities. And then you say, well, how do we do that? Well, you come up with programs to do that, and then you evaluate them and test them, and there you go. You've got these new programs. So I think that process is something I'm hoping that all racing jurisdictions will look at this and put together teams of people, the right teams of people, to look at these problems and come up with innovative solutions, because that's what we need to move forward and to make progress there. So in highlight form, Steve, I think those are the big ones, and the rest of them are not unimportant, but those are the ones that really need to get done.
Well, there's been just constant progress, and the results are clear, and the potential to continue and keep drilling those numbers down. The most important message, I think, Dr. Palmer, out of this and out of Saturday is that this is a new, added innovation in terms of the process to make decisions to keep to keep the equine athlete and their human partner safe and out of harm's way. And I yesterday on television I concluded or tried to distill it into everybody acknowledging that this is the new landscape and this is the way it's going to be. And if we want to have a racing game and industry to participate in and enjoy and bet on, then everybody's going to have to accept, you know, the changes like this. And no matter how much it inconveniences all of us, and you don't know how much effort everybody's put in, you know, whether it's connections, you know, coming from across the ocean to be here to run, or, you know, people that came to, you know, come to the racetrack to watch their horse, whatever it is. We've all got to just understand this is how it's going to be going forward.
Well, Steve, I think you're right about that. I mean, we talk about social license, and I think the handwriting's been on the wall for a while, and I think there's a cultural change happening in horse racing in North America, and it's a good thing. It's a positive thing. And is it painful? All change is painful. You know, making change, especially cultural change, is a very difficult challenge, and there's a lot of emotion involved in it. It's not just the finances and the inconveniences. There's a lot of tradition in horse racing, and, you know, we respect that, but we have to be able to adapt because the world around us is changing, and if we don't change with it, we won't be racing horses anymore. And it's pretty much that simple. And I know some folks would say, well, that's an over-dramatization, but, you know, look at the world around us. Look at the attention that people gave it to the Olympics. There was a competitor from Great Britain that was suspended for a video, I think, where this woman did something inappropriate with her. I don't want to go into details about it, but let's just say that the world is watching, and there is no tolerance for the belief that horse racing is not doing everything that it can to make it better. I think that's a responsibility, is what it really boils down to. There's one other thing I wanted to mention about recommendations that I didn't dwell on, but I think another really important one is, you know, what about this advanced imaging stuff? I'm sure everybody's heard about the PET scans and the importance of advanced imaging, and, you know, where does that fit in? And I was participating in a conference, International Horse Racing Federation conference on safety in Toronto about a month ago, and that was a fascinating meeting with people from all over the world. All racing jurisdictions around the world were there, and we talked a lot about, you know, what's the role of these sensors and how does it work with the imaging and what role does that play and all that. And I think that one of the recommendations in here was for New York to be a leader in the area of putting together a research program that sorts this out, the best use of this new technology. How do we use it the best? How can we make it affordable? How can we use it for decision-making processes? These are all things that New York can do if they're committed to doing so. So I think that's maybe even one of the most important recommendations of them all, is to figure that all out as we're going forward. But I applaud you for your work you're doing, Steve, and I think that you're really right on it in terms of figuring out, you know, the importance of what's going on here. And it gives nobody pleasure to cancel a racing card. Nobody wants to do that. But at the same time, we don't want horses to die. And if we can do something, if we know based on science, there's things we can do. And that really was the take-home message from that old report back in Aqueduct, you know, 12 years ago. The bottom line from that report was we do not have to accept the current level of high racing fatalities at New York racetracks because there's stuff we can do to make it better. And lo and behold, we did the stuff, it got better, and we're going to do more stuff, and it's going to keep getting better. But that's the thing I hope that people will focus on when they reflect on these things and understand that, yes, there are going to be inconveniences. Yes, there's going to be financial consequences. But all that pales in comparison to the consequences of ignoring those things and plowing on and having horses continue to be injured like they were years ago. We can't do that. We just can't do that. There's a really interesting book written by Temple Grandin and a professor from the American College of Inner Surgeons over in England. It's basically a book about the ethics of horse racing is a big chunk of it. And basically, there's lots of conversation about that. But one of the things that resonated with me that I'll leave you with, if we're getting close to the end of the conversation, is that we have a responsibility to the degree that we remove an animal from its natural environment. And I'm not going to go into detail about whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. But to the degree that we do that, for example, we take horses and we use them for sport, whether it's the Olympics or whether it's horse racing, whatever it is, our obligation as stewards of those animals is to do everything possible to minimize the risks for their health and safety that are associated with that change, associated with that usage, if you will, of the horse. So to the degree we do that, it's good. We're okay. We forget that, or we ignore that, or we don't accomplish that, that's no bueno. We just can't do that. It's unacceptable.
Well, and of course, the reference to Temple Grandin, of course, the professor at Urbana, that the subject of that unbelievable film, it's got to be 10, 15 years ago, when she came to awareness. I mean, in addition to being a livestock observer, I mean, famed for her autism as well. And I didn't realize there was. I'm glad you brought that out. What's the book?
I'll send you the connection for it. I don't have it in front of me right now, but basically it's an ethical the ethics of horse racing, or the ethics of animals and sport, or something like that. But it's really good, and I will definitely give it to you. But I think the philosophy piece is really important here. It's not something that we talk a lot about, Steve, but it's our connection with these animals that makes a difference. I think one of the really great comments of one of the Olympic athletes when they were confronting this controversy in Paris, there were a number of world champion equestrians that said, this is a partnership between me and my horse, and that can't be successful if there is, fear, anger, frustration, conflict. We can't perform at our best with a fear-based, reaction or philosophy. So it has to be a partnership. And I think that it's true in horse racing as well. Horses that run really well are unique, obviously, and they're wonderful, spectacular animals. But I don't think they generally respond to, abuse. They don't. That's no way. You can't be successful doing that. And I've always been convinced that great trainers and great horses, they've got a relationship that goes well beyond, the typical. There's a bond there that they've connected with, and it keeps them happy. Happy horses run faster. I believe that. So there you go.
Well, too long between drinks, as the racetrack saying goes. Dr. Scott Palmer, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to catch up, and more importantly to help people understand the decision making process on the technical side. I will also get the racing department to talk about how they're going to handle these interactions, because the gaming commission has they're having an outsized, I don't know if outsized is the right word, but they have they're going to have a very big say so in this, and then the racing department will make decisions like they made about postponing the two races and bringing them back for next Saturday. And it's a hand in glove, and we've all got to work toward the same positive goal.
Without a doubt. And I think New York horse racing has got a spectacular tradition, and it's going to continue to be spectacular. And it's I think we're all fortunate to be in this time and place and help that happen.
Dr. Scott Palmer, everybody, the New York Gaming Commission equine medical director, who has contributed so much to the improvement and the better landscape that's been crafted to protect horse and rider and the industry at large. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure to be here. I hope you have a great day. Bye-bye.
See you at the sales. There we go. Dr. Scott Palmer. And certainly you've heard I didn't realize that Dr. Palmer hadn't been on since the Aqueduct Task Force. In part because Alan Foreman, Alan is so out front on a lot of the things that that touch on all these topics, but this one uniquely tied to Saturday was the motivation, and it came
you know, within the shadow of the release of the report. I guess it was last Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever. When was the 31st? Tuesday. You know, and for those that are wondering, I almost went in, you know, we spent an hour, which I thought was perfect. I almost went into the risk factors that, you know, kind of came out of last year, because you're going to say to yourself, well, it's because they were racing young horses, and oh, it's because they're no, it's not that simple. The young horse thing is the most wrongheaded conclusion that you see most often. Oh, we shouldn't race them until they're three. No, as it happens, if you don't stress them physically, they will be more unsound later. If you, you know, delay the opportunity to, you know, work with them and train them. So that one is wrong. But a lot of the conclusions or commonalities, those, you know, there's a certain range that, you know, comes up more often than not. And that, you know, that's been a big part of, you know, how, you know, the risk factors are identified, and you work backwards from there. But, you know, the horses last summer, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. So all, fillies, colts, geldings, all wide range. And certainly, if you went through, you know, they'd say, well, it's because the horsemen aren't the same as... No, also wrong. Because, the names of the trainers that lost horses last summer, you know, includes, you know, let's see, it includes, you know, Hall of Famers. So, and the trainers that are on the ballot to be Hall of Famers. So, it's incredibly complex, and we spend as much time as we can helping people appreciate what's going into it behind the scenes. Second half is ahead, and Rich Migliori will join us. LP3, Lafitte Pinkai III, going to push Richie back. He says he's in a rotten area. He's driving down for an overnight at home. But Rob Attriss going to visit. We'll get Rob in, I think, next. And Tony Kahlo, some Ellis Park, back after this.